What up? It's the Crossover Pod Friday edition. I'm Howard Beck, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. My guest today is longtime player agent Todd Ramasar. Todd's been around a while. He once represented Baron Davis back in the day. Current clients include Pascal Siakam of the Raptors, Thomas Bryant of the Wizards, and Josh Primo, the 12th overall pick in the 2021 draft. Noteworthy because Josh Primo wasn't expected to be the 12th pick. In fact, wasn't expected to be taken according to all the mock drafts until the 20s, maybe even the late 20s. How did he get to 12th? To the Spurs? There's a story behind that, and it's a really interesting one, and Todd Ramasar is going to tell you all about it. Plus, some insights into Pascal Siakam and obviously the very difficult season he just had, not only on the court but off the court, shoulder surgery, all the trade rumors swirling around. We get into all that. We talk a little bit about Thomas Bryant and his return as well, and just about this crazy free agent period that we are still in the midst of. It's been fast and furious, and there are reasons for that, some of which involve the T word, tampering, which probably came into this conversation a couple times, more from my end than from Todd's end. And a quick note for the listeners, we did record this during the first week of free agency, so by the time you listen to this, possible that some other things have happened, hopefully not including a trade of any of the aforementioned clients of Todd Ramasar's, but so you know, we did record this a little bit before. You're probably listening to it. Before we get to that, your weekly reminder, please rate, subscribe, review The Crossover on whatever podcast platform you like to listen to podcasts on. If you ever have any feedback for me, I welcome that either on those platforms or you can hit me on Twitter at Howard Beck. Okay, my conversation with Todd Ramasar is coming up next, so stick around.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
Now, very pleased to be joined by Todd Ramasar. Todd, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Howard. Good to see you. It's been a while.
It has been a while. I feel like every conversation these days starts with that. It's been a while since I've seen a lot of people. Glad to see you on Zoom. Last time we did a podcast with my previous employer, we were able to actually do it in studio in New York, actually get to hang out a little bit. Zoom will suffice for now, I guess, until I start hitting the road again.
Well, thank God for technology. Yeah, it's always better in person, but this is the next best thing, right?
It is. It is. Zoom was not a word that we used very often in terms of meeting places until a year and a half ago, and now suddenly it's all we do. So we're talking here in early August amidst one of the I don't want to say the craziest free agent periods. Every free agent period, it seems like, is crazy now for the last 10 years. Either it's superstars, changing teams left and right, or it's something like this year, which was not a lot of the high-end talent, but just everything happened all at once. Monday night, there were, dozens of signings or agreed to signings. It was still the moratorium, technically. Tuesday, another flurry. Day three, there were a trickle. But if it everybody got snapped up so quickly, I don't remember it ever moving at this speed. I suspect it's a combination of a few different factors, but before I lead the witness too much, from the agent side of it, I'm curious, do you have any theories on what has sped up free agency to this degree?
I'll say a lot of it is, at least on the agent side, I could talk about myself, but also assume what other agents do or what I've seen in the past when I was with other agencies. It's just you do your homework before free agency begins. You have your target list. You know what teams, for the most part, are interested based on need and position. And by the time free agency hits, you pretty much know what you're asking for, and you're in quick conversations with those teams. Meetings have been set, and you pretty much know what your target list is, and it moves fast. In some ways, similar to the draft, teams have their targets. And as guys start coming off the board, signing or committing to certain teams in free agency, they move on to their next one, and it moves very fast. But I think part of the reason we've seen in at least in the last 5 years or even longer than that, the first 24 to 48 hours is when everything comes to play. And part of that, I think, is the media. You know, it's like things move fast because you have to. And then it gets reported even quicker now so that, you know, your first tier of free agents move quick because that's where most of the money is being spent in terms of cap space and other exceptions.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so I've got two major theories, I think, for this year. I'll put the second one to the side for a moment because it's a stickier one. But one of them certainly seems to be that this was not a year with a LeBron James or a Kevin Durant or multiple of those guys, right? There have been years where you've had multiple superstars, and Kevin Durant wanted everybody to come see him in the Hamptons in 2016. We've had years where, you know, Kawhi Leonard took his good time a couple of years back. We've had those years where a superstar or a combination of them have held up the proceedings because everybody's waiting on them. And then there's a domino effect because everybody, even players, not just teams, there are teams that are waiting on those guys. But then there are players who are like, well, if that guy goes there, it may leave money for me here, or I might want to go play with that guy. We didn't really have that this year, right? Like Kawhi is still, as you and I record this, Kawhi is not re-signed, but everybody assumes he's going to be with the Clippers. Chris Paul re-upped real quickly. So there was no top tier to kind of hold up the proceedings. Do you think that that was at least a significant part of it this year?
It is. I always say every free agency is a different marketplace too, right? Yes, that's a major factor. You don't have at least a young superstar that's an unrestricted free agent that is holding up the market to let, or multiple that is, you know, in some ways holding up the market and causing a domino effect of other signings. But, you know, it's like I said, every free agency is a different marketplace, you know, and even in the next few years, even if it's not a major superstar, it could be, you know, the new media rights deal, for example, in the next few years. Once that comes into place, we're going to see a different marketplace too, in terms of signings and the level of signings as well.
Yeah. All right. So the stickier theory on why free agency happened as quickly as it did. And you kind of alluded to this in very diplomatic clinical terms. Some people would say that figuring out the marketplace and what teams need and what they're willing to pay or what kind of players looking for and everything, that would actually be tampering by league rules. But we all know it happens, and nobody says it outright, but everybody knows it. And agents aren't bound by it either, by the way. So to the listeners, you should know whatever Todd and I are talking about here, he's violating absolutely nothing. Agents can do whatever they want. It's the Wild West. Maybe that's a little overstatement, but it's the teams that are bound by these rules that they do not follow. And I think it's pretty clear, Todd. So like, to the extent that you want to speak about this candidly, as candidly as you're comfortable with, right? But when we get to 6 PM in this, the case this year, 6 PM Eastern time, on August 2nd, and within minutes, seconds, there's tweets of all these deals, it's because they were already done. They were already in place. Nobody can negotiate a deal that fast, certainly when it's not sign-in trades, which were a couple of them. So to the extent you're comfortable with it, like, tell me about like the lead-up. How soon do some of these conversations happen? How detailed do you get? And from your perspective, again, like, you cannot be sanctioned for any of these conversations. It's the teams that are obligated to either decide to have the conversation or not. And if they don't, it's maybe to their own detriment because somebody else will be. So give us a little bit, if you can pull back the curtain on how those conversations go in the weeks leading up to free agency.
And I could say this, how, you know, respecting the teams, respecting my position, other agents, it's, you're having a lot, like what I mentioned earlier is, a lot of the homework is done before free agency begins. As an agent, when you're representing several players, whether it be free agents, veterans, or draft eligible players, you're having frequent conversations with the decision makers from every organization. So even if it's not as clear as saying, you know, general manager X from X team saying, hey, Todd, as he's talking about, say, for example, one of my clients, Josh Primo, in the draft, you know, I'll ask, hey, what are you looking for? Like, how are you constructing your team? What's the identity? What's your biggest need? Where are you looking to spend dollars? And, you know, through those conversations, you could put two and two together based on the client roster, especially if I have, you know, a major free agent in the market. what they could be targeting and what could be potentially a good fit.
Yeah. In a year where you have, you know, a key free agent, you know, the draft is a different animal, similar in terms of the conversations, I'm sure. But when you have a key free agent or two, and it's in a normal year where we're talking about this in June, not July, August, in a normal year, you know, are those conversations happening in early June already where you're trying to get a feel for, like, look, when July 1st hits, midnight July 1st or whatever, they, you know, the date and time changes over year to year now, it seems like. Do you already know which 2 to 3 teams have strong interest? Do you know a range of what they're willing to spend in terms of both dollar amount and years? And is that essentially the job? Like, people can call it tampering, the league can frown on it, everything else, but that's your job, right? Like, that, like, this is what you're supposed to know as the player's agent before that all happens, because you need to gauge his market. You need to make the best decisions. We've seen, I won't name names because I don't want you to have to be in that position, but we've seen some guys get kind of iced out in this cycle, and it happens a lot of years where somebody overplays their hand. So you'd be neglectful if you weren't having these conversations, no matter how the league looks at it.
Yeah, no, Howard, it's a great point. And like I said, every agent's different. I could talk about myself. Is like, I have my war room with my staff of where we, you know, basically tier all the top free agents from based on their position. And then looking at our free agents based on their position, what the right fits may be in terms of teams, right? That will have a clear need based on their depth at that position. And then also look at where they're at financially to know what exceptions they have to use. And then also from a cap space standpoint, where I think teams get caught in, agents and players get caught in that position where the market gets cold really quick, is if you don't have that checklist where you could eliminate and see where players are signing and see what's available. I'll give you a perfect example, Kevon Looney. You know, I could say now I was in talks with Chicago, obviously the Warriors and a few other teams. And they, as the market was shifting, it came down to the Warriors in Chicago. And based on what other movement was out there and other players at Kevon's position were available, I had to make a decision quick, because if I didn't advise Kevon to make that decision quickly, those teams get stuck in a bind and know that they have options available where they could easily offer it to another player. And now all of a sudden you're left out in the cold. So you really have to know the market as an agent. I think most of the homework, getting back to your question, it's for me, it's well before June what those target lists are. Yeah. And then by having conversations with teams, again, through the draft process or even when free agency hits, that list may start off at 7. But through those conversations, I'll really maybe have a top 2 or 3 based on how those conversations are going, or even looking how they've drafted, or even based on the conversations with my client, what the best fit would be moving forward. Right? Because some teams in free agency may have a lot of cap space or may be able to make a greater offer, but you know that team is not going to be competitive in that next season. And depending on where the client is at, whether they're young, you know, early in their career or even later as a veteran, talking to the client, they're going to know or want to know what their role is, and then also know how competitive that team is going to be if they're going to commit to them. So there's still a lot of factors.
Yeah. And the Looney deal you're talking about, that was from 2019, right? 2 years ago?
Correct. Correct. Yeah. We just exercised an option for him, which is the final year of his deal with the Warriors, and he'll be unrestricted free agent next summer.
Yeah. All right. So whether it's Kevon Looney getting to that point next summer or other free agents you've worked with, one of the things I feel like, I don't know if this is actually a shift, Todd, or if this is just me being more aware of it, or me being more tuned in, or just because I've covered the league forever. And, you know, eventually you start to make different observations over time, process it differently. I feel like, and tell me if I'm wrong, that free agent decisions are made across a much broader array of factors now. In other words, I think there was a time where, because the NBA set it up this way, right? You've got bird rights and various levels of bird rights, and that bird rights were really persuasive for a while. You stay with your team, you make a boatload of more money than if you walk away at every level, especially the max guys, but even lower tier guys. And so it felt like to me for a long time, guys mostly made decisions based on some combination of contract length and contract value. And now today, maybe because everybody's making a boatload, right? Like what, once upon a time, the mid-level exception was like $2.5 million and now it's $9 million. The minimum salary is higher. Everything's higher. I feel like free agents are looking, are able to prioritize other things now. Like they can look at weather. They can look at what city they would rather live in, or being close to family, or if they have a family where their family wants to be, they might prioritize being with the right coach or the right system, the right teammates. It may be to ring chase. It may be to actually go somewhere where, you know what, I just want minutes and shots. And I feel like the free agency, to the extent that it might be a little bit less predictable now, maybe it's because with the amount of money guys can make no matter where they go, that they can weigh. I've put it all into the broad heading of just happiness. You just go where it makes you happy. And it, once upon a time, that was probably more about money and maybe contending than anything. And now I feel like it could be all these things. You've been at this a long time.
Yeah.
Am I right? Have things shifted? Are players basing those decisions in the summer on more than just the basic dollars and years now?
I always say to my clients, every contract should lead to your next contract, right? And there's some risk inherent in that. But for me, for my clients, winning, you know, because obviously, you know, hindsight's 20/20 at the end of a player's career. They talk about, you know, winning championships and, you know, leaving a legacy. For me, I tell my clients, leaving a legacy is taking care of your family. You want to, this is a business. And yes, you want to be competitive, but in this business, you want to maximize your earning potential. And in making those decisions for clients as they come up in free agency, or even as it relates to where they get drafted, you want to make sure that they're in a position to maximize that earning potential. So, you know, are those things in consideration that you mentioned, Howard? Yeah. You know, the other thing is, like, I think for fans or your casual fans or I hate, you know, I'd say your fans that are following the sport that aren't on the business side, there's an analysis done as well, a sophisticated analysis, especially as the dollars increase on these contracts for clients or these players is, you know, depending on where they're signing. You know, if I have a player that's looking at free agency with a Texas team or a Florida team and the dollar value is less, there's an analysis where, you know, you could go to those states and based on their endorsement income as well as their contract income over time, the discrepancy in dollar value isn't as significant as you may think. Plus, also with anniversaries of extension signings or even options, the player is not losing as much money as people may assume based on what's being reported, because when those contracts are being reported, they're not taking in consideration the tax implications or anything else. It's just being reported as a flat number. So there's a lot more that goes into it, Howard, at least in my, you know, my estimation when I'm sitting down with my clients. And then other times it's just like, you know, you tell a client, look, you've earned this, you've earned the right to be offered this level of contract from any team in any marketplace. If you commit to that contract, it is a business decision for you and your family. If it doesn't work out, you could get traded and your contract goes with you, right? And it's as simple as that. It's a business decision. Sacrificing significant income is not something I recommend to any of my clients. Because, you know, God forbid there could be a serious injury. Look, I call it acts of God, a pandemic impacts the market. You never know what could happen. Injury, death, a number of different factors that are outside of our control. So going into any type of free agency with the client, there's an analysis. It's also understanding, you know, fit, because depending on where that client is in their career, making the simple decision to go to a competitive team with a system that's more conducive to that player's success could lead to a greater outcome 2 or 3 years later in terms of their contract value going into their next free agency.
So would you possibly in some circumstances advise or at least be more open to your client taking the lower contract, the lesser short-term payoff on a one-year deal because either they're trying to reestablish their market value or they're going to a contender, and by just the glow, the aura of walking away from a championship team makes you immediately more valuable in the marketplace? And there's somebody in mind, and you don't have to discuss this because it's not your client, but Otto Porter was making, I think, $28 million last year and just signed for the minimum with the Warriors. And I thought, wow, from a media and fan standpoint, you go, wait, wow, great value signing, right? But great value signing from an agent standpoint means somebody sacrificed a bunch of money, didn't get their market value, right? Otto Porter is definitely much more than a minimum player in this league, but it's a great signing for the Warriors. And to the extent that Otto Porter will have another contract after this, if the Warriors are back to title contention, I could see there being some residue, some benefit from that. Or maybe he just figures, I've already made my money and now I want a ring. So without necessarily getting into somebody else's client, but that concept, does it make sense?
It does. So I don't mind talking about Otto Porter what I'm going to say is respecting, I think, any agent, how they go into a marketplace. It's like, you better be realistic with your client, what their value is in a market, because the market value isn't what we perceive it to be as an agent or a player. It's what you're ultimately going to be played from a team that establishes your market value. And I'll make it analogous to the housing market, right? Today, my house could be worth $1 million. Next year, it could be worth $750,000. And the year after, it could be 1.5. As much as I have that sentimental value of my home, if I'm not pricing it right, I could either be losing money based on the equity in the home and comps in the area, or I could be overpricing it, in which, depending on what I'm trying to do, if I have to relocate, I'm not going to sell my home and I'll be stuck with that asset that's burdening me, right? And it's the same thing I say for my clients in free agency, is like, if you're holding on too tight to what your perceived market value is, and like where we're at today, Howard, we're seeing how cold this free agency market is getting now in what is day three?
Four.
That could be, or excuse me, day four. You could get 3.5. you could get stuck on the outside looking in, and guess what? You're not even looking at a minimum contract now. You're out there and the weeks are passing, and now you have to take what the market is dictating to you that, going into the season. So at least for them, they made the quick decision. They're on a contending team. I'm sure there's going to be a good role for Otto, especially with what he can do in terms of his skill set, and set himself up for free agency in the future. That's how I look at it.
If your client comes to you and actually says, look, this is a trade-off I want to make. I know I got a lot of good years left. I know I could be making 10, 15 million a year, but I want to go get a ring, and this team is going to give me, whatever, 5 million, and I can go get a ring. I'll make it up later. What do you tell your client then? Because I'm sure on some level you want to support whatever they define as their happiness, their career goals. At the same time, your job, as you noted, is no. Make every penny you can while you can, because none of this is guaranteed. You could blow out your knee tomorrow.
Yeah, so I always say I'm a fiduciary to my clients. My job is to get information, because the currency in this business that we're dealing with is a currency of information more than anything, because the information is what leads to the outcome that's financial. So look, there's one champion every year. And we could go back in every single year and say, this team should have won. But what happened? An injury happened, right? This year, hypothetically, we could say the Brooklyn Nets should have won, right? Based on injury. 2019, Kevin Durant goes down. Klay Thompson goes down. Golden State should have won. But when we look back on history, they don't take into consideration injuries. And that's what I would say to my clients, is like, yes, you could go to this team that's positioned for a championship. But if you're sacrificing millions of dollars or years on a contract just to try to achieve that goal, understand, and that's a disclaimer, you guys could easily not win. Or you could think that your role is going to be bigger on that team, and it may not be. Or you could be the one that's getting injured, and now in a different market next year or the year thereafter, any years thereafter, your market value is negatively impacted based on those factors that are outside of your control.
Yeah.
So those are other things that they have to take a look at. But at the end of the day, once I've gone through that analysis of pros and cons with the client, if they say, hey, Todd, this is what I want to do, I'm going to support them in that.
Fair. All right. So we're in the midst of free agency and you've been through this many, many times. I'm curious, do you have in the course of your career as an agent, a favorite moment, a strangest moment, most stressful moment of free agency? And is the answer to all of these questions just Baron Davis and Elton Brand in 2007?
Well, you know, it's different points in my career. That one was crazy with Baron going to the Clippers. And what we thought, you know, Elton Brand was going to remain with the Clippers.
He ended recruited Baron, right?
And then went to Philadelphia, right?
And then went to Philadelphia. So, still one of the stranger ones.
You know, I was 27 at the time doing that deal. So, you know, it's a lot different when you're 27 and you're in some ways still green just to, in terms of life experience compared to being, you know, where I'm at now at 41. And handling multiple deals over a free agency period. For me, it's, again, it's doing all of the homework before, having those targets. You know, my clients going into any contract year are being educated on what they have to do in that season to potentially reach a mark that is maybe a goal for them. You know, financially in that free agency period in the following year or following summer. So, for example, Thomas Bryant, Kevon Looney are free agents next summer, right? And I think they'll have great market value next year. I don't wait till we go into those months leading into free agency to sit them down to talk about what their potential market value may be. That's already being in some ways dictated by the Jared Allen signing maybe this year or even John Collins signing. Mm-hmm. So you already have comps being established this year. So for me, I'm sitting down with my clients, educating them to say, hey, by the end of next season, at the end of this contract year, your report card better say X if you're expecting the outcome of X, right? Because if their, you know, perceived value for them is, you know, $20 million annually, but their statistics say something otherwise, then we have a problem next year, right? Yeah. So for me, it's always about being proactive opposed to reactive, sitting them down, educating them. And as the season progresses, is talking to them, because the last thing I want is for them to get caught up in hearsay or locker room talk about, oh, I'm better than this guy, or I should be getting X, Y, and Z, when the reality is all, you know, I've done the market analysis, we've done the homework, and we know the factors that are dictating next year's market could impact my free agents. It's making sure that they have that information in real time. So the expectations are managed, you know, in this case, next offseason. And in some ways, we're exceeding expectations as an agent or an agency for our clients.
So you do all the homework, as is your job. You're diligent about it all. You try to prepare as much as you can, but there's no predicting, for instance, again, in 2007, that Elton Brand is going to recruit Baron to the Clippers, thinking we're going to form this really potent team and then have Elton turn around and go. So the curveballs do happen. That one's a really unusual one, right? We've rarely seen a verbal agreement during the moratorium and then a change of mind, change of heart.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, Howard, Baron, it was a win. Look, it didn't work out the way we wanted. Baron got $70 million in five. If you go back into that market, the Warriors under their previous ownership was not going to pay Baron. They just were not. And a lot of things had to happen in that free agency. Some players had to opt out of their deal and go elsewhere for cap space to be open up, even on the Clippers. In Elton Brand's departure, I was able to get even more money for Baron in his contract than what we previously would have gotten had Elton stayed. So it was a win at the end of the day for Baron in terms of the contract that he received, and nobody expected it. We had a ETO in the contract And that was pretty crazy. Literally, I flew up a trusted intern with the ETO letter to exercise that, and he was waiting outside of Warriors offices when they were based there in Oakland. Yeah. And I was timing it based on the market to see who else was exercising their player option. And I think it was about 10 to 15 minutes before the deadline in which he walked it in and handed it to management. And that's where Barron opted out for us to get what would eventually be the deal with the Clippers. So, and then it, again, that sends a domino effect in the rest of the marketplace for guys to end up with different teams.
So it's a win because Barron still gets paid, which is great, and had some good years with the Clippers. Still, that had to be just dizzying, and you guys had to be pissed at the time, but because the partnership with Elton could have been on a competitive level, right? There's always two levels at work here. There's the basketball, and then there's the business. The business worked out. The basketball could have worked out better if not for this, you know, once in a blue moon kind of curveball.
Yeah, look, it was disappointing that Elton didn't stick around. But look, Barron had a close relationship with Elton. Elton got a significant contract from Philly. And you could argue, hey, both guys won. And then the success that both guys had with both organizations wasn't the greatest. So should Elton have stayed? I thought so. I thought Barron and, you know, that pairing of Barron and Elton would have been much better than I think them being on separate or other teams. But at the end of the day, look, a lot of things happened. Barron did not finish out that contract with the Clippers. But at the end of the day, what he signed for is what he ultimately received, and that's a win at the end of the day.
Fair enough. Speaking of wins, you represent Josh Primo, who went 12th overall to the San Antonio Spurs. I say speaking of wins because, and I was just glancing back just to make sure I remember this correctly, ESPN and mock drafts are, even the mock drafters themselves will tell you. I wrote a story about this for the Times years ago, and the mock draft experts will tell you, like, I'm just trying to get the right range. I'm not telling you this will go exactly to form. That's impossible. You're proud of it when you get it right, but it's all about at least getting the range right. But the range wasn't even right on this one. This is not to pick on anybody. ESPN had Josh Primo 28th. My colleague at Sports Illustrated, Jeremy Wu, had him 24th. He was the youngest player in the draft, and so I think that feeds into a lot of maybe the potential volatility within the draft because you're betting on youth, you're betting on a little less of a track record, or maybe you're betting on more upside, however you want to look at glass half full, glass half empty. So it's interesting. But he goes 12th to the Spurs. And maybe part of that surprise is because it's the Spurs and they don't tell anybody anything. Can you give me, again, pull back the curtain, question number two for the podcast. Like, how does Josh Primo end up 12th after everybody's got him late first round?
You know, it's probably along the lines of how does Pascal Siakam get drafted 27th and end up with a max contract? You know, it's, at the end of the day, I always tell my clients, we're going to stick to what's within our control. Josh Primo, number one, and I'll, you know, different than Pascal, I'll make it public because I told people about Pascal. Josh Primo is an exceptional talent. If he went higher, I would not have been surprised. The reality is there was one team that would have taken him higher. I won't put them out there, but one player fell to them. And they ultimately went with that player that was rated higher than Josh by one spot. But Josh would have been drafted higher had that player not fallen. What I would say to your colleagues at some of these media outlets is if they would have called me, I would have told them exactly where they would have where he would have ended up at.
But we expect you to tell us that.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to broadcast it because I need to protect exactly the teams that are interested in drafting the client and going from there. But I already knew where Josh was slotted on the high end and then also on the low end. And the teams I talked to knew that. I talked to one team and they said, Todd, I know you told me that he could be drafted here, but I was still surprised. And the reality is, Howard, like for me, I spend a lot of time in the gym with my clients because if I'm seeing a client do exceptionally well. And Josh is obviously now 18 and a half. If I'm seeing him competing against 20, 21, 23 year olds, and in some cases against some NBA players, and he's holding his own at a high level, I know what I have, whether he's drafted at 12 or 25. And, you know, for San Antonio, they saw that value in him and they actually saw it early. It's just in this process where that may have started off at, say, 41 for the Spurs, over time, as they're seeing it based on the strategy and the plan that I had outlined for Josh, in which Josh and his family were in agreement with, as that played out and he was at the combine or he was going into these individual workouts and you saw his progression and ascension in this pre-draft process, that's where the Spurs were even that much more confident that they had their guy in Josh Primo at 12. And if it wasn't the Spurs at 12, you better believe he would have still been drafted in the teens or even, as I mentioned, even higher than the Spurs. But it was, for me, it's the perfect marriage. And I couldn't be more ecstatic about where Josh is drafted to. The Spurs are a gold standard team. We've seen what they've done with Tim Duncan, David Robinson, even as recent as Kawhi Leonard. Josh Primo is the next in line. I think, in my personal opinion, with the player development, where his mind state is at, his talent, he's going to be an exceptional talent in this league for years to come.
I mean, you played the game yourself, so you're not coming to this just as an agent either. And I'm sure every agent, especially even those who came up through the lawyer ranks or never played the game, everybody gets a sense after a while or has some confidence in their ability to kind of like assess their own clients and upside. What is it that you saw as you and Josh Primo are coming together? And actually, if you could tell us a little bit about how client and agent kind of, formed the partnership at the outset anyway. But was there something about him that you learned either before he was your client or somewhere along the way that you thought, you know what, like, you know, I like all my clients. I believe in all my clients, of course, but there's something different, something special about this kid. What stood out?
What stood out was just his skill set at such a young age. There's things that he can do on the court. If you look at, I always say, you know, you can look at a player's feet. You know, if you look at his feet and his movement and his ambidexterity, like he's doing it at a high level. And then you look at his physical attributes, his athleticism, and then the holy grail is where players' BBIQ is based on their age and where they're at. His IQ and his feel for the game is really high for someone at 18 and a half. And it's incredible, like I said, for me being in the gym every day for 2 to 3 months watching his progression, he's so young. It's like his body and his brain, like you're seeing the flashes and the connections are coming together every week that passes. For me, I always put high-level teachers around my clients, MBA teachers, which I call them teachers, not coaches, so that they're not only developing the physical, for my clients, or in this case, Josh, they're also developing the cerebral approach a player should have in terms of, what their role or their skill set is. And as that was getting thrown at Josh, seeing him take that in and then seeing him apply it very quickly on the court, you know, that's where I'm betting or knowing that he's going to have a very successful career, because it's just all coming together and he's only 18 and a half years old. And for all of us, Howard, we've all been 18 before, you know,
been
the
a while.
Difference between 18 and 19 or 18 and 20 is huge just in terms of physical development, not even to mention mental and emotional development. So the fact that he's there now, you let Mother Nature take its course, he's going to be very good in the future.
Yeah. And he's with a franchise. I mean, you said you're ecstatic. I mean, I would be too, if I were representing or were part of Josh Primo's, circle. Like, there are few organizations that you could think of that would be, you know, better than, maybe none better than, for a young player to develop. There's a handful that we could point to that are just really great at player development, and especially when you're the youngest player in your draft class. And the Spurs have done such a fabulous job. I mean, you mentioned the stars, right? The Hall of Fame types, you know, Robinson, Duncan, Kawhi Leonard, but look at DeJounte Murray. Look at, you know, some of the others of more recent vintage.
Manu Ginobili, Tony Parker. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, I could go even further. Look at their development of international players. Josh Primo is still an international player from Canada. So the fact that, you know, RC and Popovich and, and Brian Wright and Dave Tellep in that front office, and then Chip England on the coaching staff in terms of development. And then the fact that that organization is evolving too with the times, I'm excited for Josh because the pedigree is there on both sides and it's set up to be a perfect marriage. I know the kid loves the game. He works his ass off, and that's a good start for what has worked well with the franchise. And like I said, I'm betting that he's going to have a phenomenal career moving forward. And I may even be understating it by saying that.
I look forward to that all coming to fruition. It'll be fun to watch. By the way, like, I know he's only 18. I know I'm old now, having covered this league for 24 years. But man, that kid, I looked at him on draft. I'm like, he's just got such a baby face to him. It's like made me feel that much older, because like not every rookie necessarily looks it. And then some you just look at and go, my God, he's a baby. Like, yeah. And then you're
reminded how Josh looks like he's 16, even though he's 18. Exactly. But I tell you, you sit down with him, Howard. You sit down and you talk to Josh. He's wise beyond his years. You don't feel like you're talking to an 18-year-old. And there's moments where you see the 18-year-old, but in terms of his understanding of not only the game, but what he wants out of his career, he's a very focused individual. And like I said, he has all the attributes and even is going to be in an environment to have a very successful career.
All right. So tell me, how do you go about and choosing? And obviously the client chooses you essentially, but you choose on who you're going to pursue as they're coming up the ranks, whether it's, you know, through college or other avenues. And you know, you can't sign everybody. You don't want to spread yourself too thin. You keep it, I think, a fairly tight stable. How do you and Josh Primo come together, and how much of that is you choosing him versus him choosing you? In the end, he does that. Obviously he hires you, he and his family hire you, but you put in the concentration or the focus there. So how did you go about that?
Well, and it's funny, Howard, I was going to say, I could argue like I choose the client too, because there's been times where I recruit players where I'll say it's not a good fit. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, it's all about fit, and I'm not for everybody, and I don't want to be for everybody, because the things that I'm advocating in that recruiting process to my clients is really simple. It's, you know, it's giving them the best resources to be successful. Based on, you know, the relationships that I have or the coaches that I may employ to be around them, or sports science or whatever the case may be. And I don't sugarcoat things. And for the clients that buy into it are the clients that have great outcomes. The Pascal Siakams getting drafted and being a max player, the Josh Primo that is projected to be a second round pick, that's a lottery pick that, you know, surpassed a lot of players that were projected higher than him to begin this process. And if somebody said, well, Todd, how did you do it? Or even, you know, Josh, when we sit down, is like, you know, Josh, we're not surprised. We had a plan and you worked your ass off. You never complained. You bought into it. Your family bought into it. And then here's the outcome. So for me, going through that recruiting process, obviously the player has to be talented, but they have to buy into what's going to help them not only be successful in this draft process or successful in their first few years of getting into that second contract, but what's going to help them sustain that success throughout their career so that they can leave a legacy behind them. That's what I'm, I guess you could say, selling or promoting to my potential clients that eventually become my clients. And then we go out and execute.
I want to hit this one point real quick before we move on. You did allude to having a set of what you said were teachers, not coaches, but I think it includes coaches. And I know that you did have a strategy for trying to get not just get Josh Primo ready for the draft, but to put him in the best possible position to move up beyond what some of the expectations, whether those expectations were accurate or not, were. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about who you hired or who worked with you and Josh to get him ready and to put him in that better position?
Yeah. So I went back to one of my old friends, Earl Watson. Previously it was Rico Hines. These are two guys that were my former teammates at UCLA and like brothers to me. But aside from the respect that I have or our relationship, they're phenomenal coaches in terms of their pedigree. Obviously, Rico Hines is on Sacramento Kings, so he could not do my pre-draft because he was employed. Earl Watson, obviously 13 years in the NBA, played point guard and was a former head coach of the Phoenix Suns. So I was able to go to Earl as a former head coach and bring him on board. Also, John Lucas III, that had a longstanding NBA career, was an assistant coach under Tom Thibodeau in Minnesota for three seasons after his career, as well as a second generation player development coach, because we know the reputation of his father in Houston. I had a third NBA coach in David Gale and some other coaches, Jared Cook, that are all in it for the right reasons in terms of teaching the game, both on and off the court. So I was able to give Josh these former NBA players that are also player development coaches, and they were in the gym with him for hours, some in a group setting, some in an individual group setting. And for Earl Watson, you go back and you look at him, his time with the Phoenix Suns, and even more recently, Devin Booker giving him a lot of credit for his development. Earl was seeing a lot of similarities with Primo in addition to or what he saw in Primo, similar to what he saw in Devin Booker early in his career, departing Kentucky after 1 year. So me being able to be in the gym and watch my coaches work with Josh and my other clients, and then be able every day or every week to sit down and say, you know, where is this player at in terms of their progression of what we're trying to accomplish in this draft process? It's great to have those conversations, especially with guys that can be very objective about where they see the client. Because for me as an agent, yes, I'm going to be biased because these guys are my clients. Doesn't necessarily mean I'm wrong in my bias, but to really be able to critique where they're at and talk and communicate with my players, with those coaches alongside of me, I think is invaluable, because it gives them a strong foundation coming in this league and setting them up for success moving forward.
Do you think that whole process, Todd, actually was part of his leap up the draft boards? Do you think he would have been there anyway based on potential? Do you think that teams, to the extent that they did maybe individual workouts later in the process after all of this gym time with the coaches you mentioned, did that partially result in him making that leap up the board to where the Spurs are confident taking him at 12?
Howard, you always need a little bit of luck in this business. You really do. Teams need a little bit of luck to identify that player and have them fall to them. We need a little bit of luck for things to work out. Like I said, you know, Josh Primo's favorite team that he wanted to play for coming into this process was the San Antonio Spurs. This is pre-lottery. This is, pre-us even getting started with our workouts. And his goal was to be a lottery pick. You know, for me, it's managing expectations as an agent. But look, if that's the client's goal and I see the potential there, my job is to, try to fulfill that as much as possible. So would the teams have seen that? I think with Josh, no, because he averaged under 10 points. He's the youngest player in the draft. He was coming off the bench for Alabama. I had to make sure I knew what I had in Josh, and I developed that. And we put in the work. I also had to make sure I sat down with Josh and his family step by step to explain the process and educate them so that they weren't getting deterred by mock drafts or hearsay or everything else. And then I had to make the decision to have him participate at the combine. Also, as I said, Howard, earlier, no different in free agency with the draft. Every draft is a different marketplace. What do I mean by that? I talked to my staff, and from the conversations I had with teams going in, we're in a pandemic year. So for scouts going to college games, they weren't seeing players live as much as they would have liked to. Plus, I'm being sensitive to NBA teams. They've been thrown curveballs in terms of the season starting later. Shorter season, you know, the pressures that come along with that. So decision makers maybe didn't see players as much as they would have liked to, right? So taking that into consideration, what I said for my clients in some ways is I need to expose you more than I normally would in any other previous draft process that isn't dealing with a pandemic, because I need to make sure teams are seeing you. If this was a normal circumstances or draft process, Josh probably would not have worked out for as many teams. He may not have participated at the combine, and he may still he still would have been drafted lottery. In this year, because of those circumstances, I had to make sure that he got in front of the team. I had to make sure that I was speaking to teams and articulating exactly what I saw. And then it was for them to take what I was saying and see him in these individual team workouts or even at the combine to say, you know what Todd is sharing with us is actually accurate. And we need to do our due diligence, look at him more, you know, understand his age, understand where he's at from a development standpoint, and then make a decision. And we see what the outcome is. So that's all part of strategy and in some ways a little bit of luck.
Yeah.
But I always believe you can make your own luck or increase your chances of being lucky. And that's what we did. And it all worked out.
It worked out phenomenally, clearly. Let's wrap up with a couple quick hits on two of your other clients. How is Thomas Bryant? And he was off to such a nice start last season before the injury. Tough for him, tough for the Wizards, clearly impacted their season greatly. Where do things stand with him just in terms of his health and his outlook for the season?
He's right on par of where he should be. Obviously, Howard, if you follow guys that have ACL injuries, they usually come back stronger. Not only is he with a good organization and has the support of Tommy Shepard in management, but I've complimented his rehab. He's with Andy Barr, who's one of the best of the best. Worked with Kevin Durant with his Achilles rehab, Paul George with his ankle. He's one of the best in the business. So I think, to be honest with you, Howard, the injury is going to be a blessing in disguise for Thomas. One, because, again, that knee is going to come back stronger from his rehab. And just the way that, you know, these procedures are done, he had Dr. Allcheck do it at HSS in New York. But also, and you know this, I'm really into the sports science and health of my clients. Because he was, because of the injury, we're able to address some other things biomechanically that was going on with his body. I think Thomas is going to come back and be even more athletic and be able to run the floor even better. And we'll be able to prevent even any further injuries to his body. So here's a guy that just turned 24 years old, shot over 40% from three, had an exceptional bubble, and started off the season great. I think with all the moves that the Wizards have made and him coming back in healthy, he's set up to have a phenomenal year and have a phenomenal outcome in free agency next summer.
Of course, in the meantime, they kind of loaded up at his position. They got Montrezl Harrell in that Russell Westbrook deal. Daniel Gafford was a revelation for them. Yep. So a little competition, I assume, as his advocate, you'll say, no sweat for us. He's going to be the starter when he's healthy.
Howard, I'm big on staying control of the things that are in your control, right? Yeah. And in this business, it's still a simple business. It's the business of basketball. So for my guys, I tell them, have game. Don't sit here and look at the things that are out of your control or the depth. Say, you know what? These are guys that can actually help our team win, help our team make it to the playoffs, and I'm going to come in and just have more game than them. Yeah. If you have more game, then the rest figures itself out because the pressure is now on Wes Unseld in this case, new head coach, and management because his talent's going to be there. Thomas's talent isn't going anywhere. And like I said, he's going to come back healthier and stronger, and it's for him to go in there and just compete. The rest will take care of itself, but it's no sense in worrying about things that are outside of his control or our control when his focus should be on getting healthy and coming back better than before.
Which is the perfect segue for the last thing here, your other client, your most prominent, perhaps, client, Pascal Siakam, because speaking of things you can control or not control, a lot of trade speculation, and obviously they drafted a guy in Scotty Barnes that just fueled that speculation that much more. Are these guys all going to play together? Does this free them up to trade Pascal Siakam? And those talks, or that speculation has been going on for a while. Part of that is related to him having a tough season. The Raptors had a tough season, and they spent the entire year in Tampa and played 72 road games, essentially. And so I think a lot of I wrote about this about a month ago. It's really hard to evaluate a lot of things that happened in the league this year, but no more than, no team would be harder to evaluate looking back than the Raptors, the one team that spent an entire season not even in its own market. So where do you think Pascal is at this stage? What's your concern level just about, you know, his game? Like, forget the trade speculation, but I'm curious about that too. What do you think of where his future lies and how, you know, how, what do you do in a time like this season where he's having a tough go of it on various levels and there's all this stuff swirling around?
Yeah, you know, Howard, I tell you, it's a great question. For me, there is no concern because, again, if we're living by the mantra, stay in control of the things you have control over, a lot of the things that transpired that people aren't aware of for Pascal that I feel for him were out of his control. And I'm a big believer adversity builds character. Every great superstar has gone through criticism and adversity with circumstances that may have been out of their control. If I go back to when the pandemic hit, people don't understand that Pascal was stuck in Canada. And if you know what's going on with the Canadians or the country of Canada as it relates to this pandemic, you can't move around like you did here in the States, depending on what market you're in. So for him, pre-bubble, there's only so much he could have done in terms of even working out or hitting a court. And you saw that in his play in the bubble. Pascal knows that it wasn't up to par. I know that it wasn't up to par in management. But that wasn't because he chose not to work on his game. It was based on circumstances that were out of his control. Had he been in Los Angeles or able to travel to LA or even the US for that matter, I would have been able to put a lot of things in place even during the pandemic, like I was for Thomas Bryant. And you saw Thomas's play in the bubble as well as some of my other clients that were able to work out and at least have things manageable, but Pascal wasn't. And then during the season, you know, you take circumstances like finding out 2 weeks before the season begins that you're not going to be in your team city. You're going to be relocated to Tampa, Florida, where every home game is an away game, right? And then you take, for example, the fact that in the middle of the season, he gets struck with COVID, right? As he's starting to build momentum, and then he's out for a month. So, and then he comes back, and then in a play in early May, defending a player, you're coming off a screen and you get clipped, he has a shoulder injury. So the conversations that we have, and I won't dive into it, is like, again, stay in control of the things you have control over, which he's doing an exceptional job with his rehab, doing an exceptional job with his body. And then now, you know, he's been on the court and he's working. I love the moves the Raptors have done. They've gotten bigger, they've gotten more athletic, and they've gotten those things with more skill at every position. They've hired Earl Watson. So now they have a player development coach and assistant coach with head coaching experience that's going to be working very closely with Pascal. They hired an exceptional player development coach from Charlotte, and then they've ramped up their overall coaching staff. And then here's the thing, there's no pressure. I think the Raptors, you look at their management, you look at their history, you look at the factors that they were dealt with this season. In some ways, it could be a blessing in disguise that they were able to get a lottery pick, because under normal circumstances, they're usually winning 50 games a year and they're not in the lottery, right? They traded Kyle Lowry, got some good pieces back, and they're not done with their moves. So I'm excited for Pascal. Obviously, the focus and the emphasis right now is rehabbing his shoulder to get back to even stronger than before. And not saying we're out of the pandemic, but knowing that the pandemic now is manageable and there's not the stress of that. And now they're heading back to Toronto and our season is back into a normal timeline. There's nothing but good things to come. And the other blessing is, look, they didn't make it to the playoffs. Even despite having the shoulder injury and surgery, his body is resting. The last few seasons, they've gone into the playoffs or made a deep run with the championship, and then pandemic circumstances that we had to deal with last offseason. These are more ideal circumstances to have a much better season next year and prove critics wrong. And as far as trade rumors, any player could be traded. I can't, like, those are things that are in some ways within our control, but out of our control. Pascal is professional. He has game. The rest will take care of itself. If he's traded, so be it. Players get traded every single year, even at his level. But again, within his control is to have game. Yeah. And that's whether it's with the Raptors or anywhere else.
All good advice. Wise words. Well, I look forward to seeing Pascal healthy and back on the court again somewhere, wherever that may be. Look forward to seeing Thomas Bryant back out on the court. Look forward to seeing what Josh Primo can do. This has been fun. Glad we got a chance to reconnect, do this again. It had been too long, and hopefully next time we chat, it's in person in a gym somewhere on the continent.
I know. Always good catching up with you, Howard. I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate you wishing my guys a good season. I'm feeling pretty good about where things are at in these next few months or this upcoming season, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it at some point again.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, that's it for today's show. My thanks again to Todd Ramasar. Thanks to our producer, Shelby Royston. Thank you all for listening. Remember, you can hear Chris Mannix and me every Tuesday on The Crossover with all the latest NBA chatter. And then on Fridays, it's me and a guest. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and hit me with all your feedback on Twitter at Howard Beck.